From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is Evan Fowler.
This hearing is about making sure that every newborn baby has a fighting chance, whether she's born in a labor and delivery ward or whether she's born in an abortion clinic.
Well, that's Ben Sasse, the Nebraska senator, and what he's just said is going to be is kind of a tip-off to our first segment in today's Washington Watch broadcast. By the way, great to be here today, sitting in for Tony. Glad you're listening as well. So let me tell you what's going on today. Our first segment will include Jill Stanek. She's a former labor and delivery nurse who discovered babies were being aborted alive to die without medical care. And she also testified at last week's Senate hearing on the Born Alive bill. And she'll talk with us about responding to the left's claims that babies surviving an abortion doesn't really happen. It's kind of a battle of ideas, and it's very important that we get the truth out about this. In our second segment, Dan Gaynor, Vice President for Tech Watch, will join us, and we'll talk about why we should consider defunding PBS, the Panhandler Broadcasting System, as I call it, and Sesame Street, now that they've decided to feature a drag queen in one of their episodes. At the bottom of the hour, Dr. Michelle Critella will join us. She's the executive director of the American College of Pediatricians, and we'll discuss the unfairness of female athletes being forced to compete against biological males. And we'll talk about a new lawsuit against the state of Connecticut filed by three female athletes who were forced to compete against and lose to males who think they're girls. And the final segment, we'll be talking with Travis Weber, FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, and Ariel Del Turco, FRC's Research Assistant for FRC's Center for Religious Freedom. And they'll talk with us, update us on persecution of Christians around the world and what sorts of things are going on to help against that effort. Well, let me just read a little bit from today's FRC update email. And by the way, if you don't receive those emails, they're very informative. Doesn't take that much time to read them each day, and they keep you up to date on what's going on. And you can find that at TonyPerkins.com. Sign up for it. I highly recommend it. But let me just read a little bit from today's before we start talking with Jill Stanek here. So here it goes. You never happened. Imagine sitting down to that headline if you're Melissa Odin, Jonna Jessen, or one of a thousand other victims the media says don't exist. Vox, the liberal publication, even put the phrase abortion survivors in scare quotes, as if the punctuation would help convince America that documented cases aren't real. Of course, there's a reason Democrats are desperate for people to believe this is a fake issue. They're hoping the country will ignore their, the Democrats, inhumanity. Quote, Senate Republicans want to protect babies born alive after an abortion. Vice scoffed. That doesn't happen. That's their claim. Writing for the site, Carter Sherman goes on to argue that pro-lifers are somehow conflating infanticide with, quote, end-of-life care. But end-of-life care that ends in death isn't care at all, a fact that isn't lost on most reasonable people. And if the end of life is at its start, then let's not fool ourselves. We're talking about infanticide, not letting the infant pass naturally, as Vice so blithely puts it. One more paragraph from today's update from FRC. At one point, Sherman, realizing he's the writer from Vox, realizing the facts are bound to catch up with him, admits there are, quote, exceedingly rare situations where infants show signs of life after attempted abortion. So we've gone from that doesn't happen to the casualties are too few to worry about. He points to the 143 born alive deaths listed in the CDC's report with a shrug, never mentioning that these only are the members or the numbers from six U.S. states. The government couldn't factor in the other 44, like Virginia, where infanticide is so common that Governor Ralph Northam referred to it as comfort care. But the reality is it shouldn't matter how many babies were left to die. Rareness doesn't equal rightness. Again, that's from FRC's daily update from today. Jill Stanek is a former labor and delivery nurse, and she discovered in her own facility where she was working that this was happening. Jill, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me on.
Well, all right. Tell us your story. I know your story. I've heard your name, but a lot of the folks listening right now don't know you. So tell us who you are, and then we'll get into the story here.
Well, I was a registered nurse at Christ Hospital on the southwest side of Chicago in 1999 when I discovered that the hospital was not only involved in late-term abortions, but the procedure that it used, called induced labor abortion, sometimes resulted in babies being aborted alive. And if they were aborted alive, they were shelved to die in the hospital's soiled utility room without any medical attention. And one night, a nursing coworker was taking a little abortion survivor to the soiled utility room to die. And when she told me what she was doing, I couldn't bear the thought of this suffering child dying alone. And so I cradled and rocked him for the 45 minutes that he lived. He was just 2 days younger than little Ellie, if your listeners watched the State of the Union address and President Trump introduced her as a survivor at 2 years, who'd been born at 21 weeks, 6 days. She was 2 days older than the baby I held. And he'd been aborted because he had Down syndrome. He couldn't move very much because he was using all of his energy attempting to breathe. And after he passed away, I took him to the morgue where we took all of our dead patients. So the hospital knew exactly this was a human being. And after this, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, so this is the first time you discovered it, but how long, as far as you know, how long had this been going on at, and let me emphasize the name, Christ Hospital in Illinois?
Yes. When I was called in for a meeting with my department superiors after I wrote a letter of complaint to the hospital religious leaders, I couldn't believe that they knew what was going on, but they did. They told me that they'd been committing this type of abortion for 20 years, since 1978, without any policy whatsoever. And they were in the midst of writing a policy at that time.
All right. So, and then how much longer did it go on? And is it still going on at that facility?
It's still going on. And they said that they wouldn't stop. They said they didn't make it up. They are a part of Advocate Healthcare Systems, and they did go on and write a policy that allows for abortion of babies under certain circumstances.
All right. So how many other healthcare professionals, because you've been speaking about this for some time now, how many other healthcare professionals are out there who have also run into this practice?
I think that anybody who has worked at a hospital that commits induced labor abortion has probably seen it. Induced labor abortion is just as it sounds. The doctors induce labor on a baby they think is very premature and will not survive or die soon after the birth process, or a baby who's very sick. And sometimes the doctors will kill the babies ahead of time by injecting the baby's heart through the mom's abdomen with medicine or potassium chloride that causes instant cardiac arrest, and sometimes they will not. And so in the event at Christ Hospital, the spokesperson at the time that I went public admitted to the Chicago Sun-Times that between 10 and 20% survived there for a short period. So that's, between 1 in 10 and 1 in 5. And my experience was the number was much higher, but even that is bad.
So you heard me read an excerpt from today's FRC Daily Update and just quote some of what was said in an article in Vox. And it seems that, and I received a number of other articles in the mainstream media where they're trying to convince us that this doesn't really happen. And you testified last week with regard to the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act. Give us kind of a synopsis of what you talked about and what you testified about at that hearing.
Well, I started out by quoting Governor Northam, who you mentioned at the beginning, and he is a pediatric neurologist, and he was responding to complaints about a bill that had been introduced in the Virginia legislature that would remove protections for abortion survivors. And he said during this interview, "I can tell you exactly what would happen. The infant would be delivered, the infant would be kept comfortable, and the infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired." And what Governor Northam was describing was exactly what I experienced at Christ Hospital, but just on the other side of that decision, you know, holding an abortion survivor. So I gave my testimony of my experience at Christ Hospital. I also described that after I went public, Christ Hospital unveiled its comfort room, so no longer were nurses taking babies to the soiled utility room. They were taking them to the comfort room to die, and this was a small, nicely decorated room complete with a first photo machine in case parents wanted professional pictures taken of their aborted babies, baptismal supplies in case they wanted their aborted babies baptized, and a foot printer and baby bracelets in case they wanted keepsakes of their aborted babies. And I submitted photos that I took of the comfort room with my testimony and concluded by saying, how far will doctors go to make themselves comfortable with aborting babies alive and letting them die? And the answer is, it's pretty clear. They'll go far.
All right, so the comfort room sounds to me like a euphemism, kind of like choice is a euphemism for abortion. I want to ask you, as a former nurse, a medical professional, and you can kind of tell me where, you know, the limits of your training are, but oftentimes the left and the pro-aborts will say, well, these children that are aborted in late stage are only those who have severe abnormalities. Now, is that the case or not?
That's absolutely false. I'm quoting, I have an article pulled up just in case we were going to go here from the Washington Post, and it was quoting a study that was conducted by University of California, San Francisco researchers, and this study was backed by Guttmacher Institute, which is Planned Parenthood's research arm, and they studied women who get late abortions and concluded that most women who get late abortions get them for the same reasons as women who get abortions in their first trimester. And they described five categories of mothers who got abortions. None of these had anything to do with fetal anomalies. Raising children alone, were depressed or using illicit substances, were having fights with their partner or about experiencing domestic violence, and trouble deciding whether to get an abortion. And then once they decided, they had gone on farther than normally people get abortions. So the Vice article said that we were conflating babies who are born, who are going to die, and it's the opposite. They are conflating.
Right. And, you know, and as difficult as these circumstances that you just mentioned are in the lives of women, and we sympathize and empathize with them, that does not justify the taking of the life of that unborn child at all. Well, Jill Stanek, thank you so much for your stand, for taking the stand that you did, and also for helping to testify last week.
Thank you, Evan.
Well, coming up, Sesame Street is set to feature a drag queen. Bet you didn't know that. Should we be funding this with taxpayer dollars? We'll be talking to the Vice President for TechWatch, Business and Culture at the Media Research Center, Dan Gaynor, and we'll be talking about it right after this break. Stay with us. You're listening to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemicalabortion.
China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history.
the Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at frcblog.com.
What other trip to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, president of Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. You'll discover the roots of your faith and learn from experts about the geopolitical landscape of the region. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
We all need to be lectured sometimes. Family Research Council's new podcast features selected talks by top thinkers from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast podium takes on tough issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Listen with us to the lecture, then stick around afterward as we break down the content. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Ever heard the term toxic masculinity? Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Some progressive universities are offering courses to help men unlearn rigid definitions of masculinity, treating it as if it were a mental health condition. Thankfully, the culture doesn't have the last word on manhood. God does. Check out our StandCourageous.com for an event in your area. That's StandCourageous.com.
You're listening to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. Glad to be here. Glad you are listening. Well, in our second segment, PBS's beloved Sesame Street is set to feature an upcoming guest appearance by actor and LGBT activist Billy Porter while he wears a ballroom gown throughout the episode. That should be fun. Should an early education program that receives federal funding, meaning your dollars and my dollars, for its educational purposes be promoting political sexual issues? Is that where we want our tax dollars going? Joining me now to talk about this is Vice President for TechWatch Business and Culture at the Media Research Center, Dan Gaynor. Dan, glad to have you along today.
It's a pleasure to be talking about something that really just so upsetting, I think, for many people listening right now.
All right. So Billy Porter, I've never heard of him. I'm not planning to watch the episode where he wears a ballroom gown. But tell us, fill us in on the background for this whole thing, if you would.
Well, he's known for this show, Kinky Boots. And so he's, you know, Hollywood loves it. And, you know, Hollywood is always trying to push the envelope. Well, they've been trying to do that for years in Sesame Street. Rumors that, you know, a couple of the Sesame Street characters are gay, and there's a lot of pressure to, you know, have that public. I mean, even to the point where there were, you know, op-eds run. USA Today had one, I think it was at the end of last year, saying it's time for, you know, after the year, it's time to bring LGBTQ plus characters to America Sesame Street. So very quickly, soon after that pressure, turn around. Here we are in the celebration of LGBT month, which I thought was every month these days.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're getting. And you know, there's no attempt ever to embrace anything on the other side of the spectrum. We're not going to talk about religion from a more traditional standpoint. We're not going to talk about anything from a more traditional standpoint. We're always pushing the envelope farther and farther to the left.
All right. So tell us about the funding mechanism here. I call it the Panhandler Broadcasting System because it's getting dollars from taxpayers. And explain the whole funding thing and how Corporation for Public Broadcasting is involved.
Yeah, well, the money from government goes to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. From there, it goes to PBS or, you know, and then out to out from there. It's not a lot of money. But it is, and what's bizarre is for a long time, Sesame Street was making money for PBS, but somehow we're still supposed to fund it.
Right.
And, every time this issue comes up, I did a CNN spot a couple of years ago talking about this. And, every time the issue comes up, they trot out Big Bird, like you're killing Big Bird. You're personally going to fricassee Big Bird.
It's time.
No, you're not. It's Big Bird's not in jeopardy. It's the other programming. And, these networks would probably do better without public funding. Because PBS would get tons of lefty billionaires raining cash on them. Instead, ordinary tax dollars are going to this. Ordinary Americans who are appalled at the things they see on PBS and the constant leftward tilt of PBS and NPR, we still have to fund them.
Well, yeah, you mentioned NPR, National Panhandler Radio, and, they describe the March for Life. They use this pretzel-twisted term, anti-abortion rights activists, when referring to people, to pro-life people. And as you say, if you watch anything on PBS, which I rarely have, and once in a while they have good programs on there, you have to admit it, but they have a lot of money that they can use to produce it. But you see this role of all of these foundations and trusts and viewers like you who are providing the funding for PBS, same thing with NPR. It's not public broadcasting anymore, because if it were public broadcasting, there would be a wide spectrum of viewpoints and not this leaning that we have seen for a long, long time. So I agree with you. It's time to cut off the funding to both of those organizations and let them fund themselves like all the rest of us have to do.
Right. And what we end up with is PBS and NPR are funded by tax dollars and then use those tax dollars to go and compete with the very people who have to pay those tax dollars. So if you're a broadcaster in much of America, you're one of your competitors who's getting tons of money from corporate America is competing with you, and they're using your tax dollars to do it. So it's not only is it left wing, but this is the quintessential example of what happens, why government should stay out of media, because it's propaganda. It's not just government-funded media. Government-funded media, by definition, is propaganda. It will always push forth the agenda of the people they think are writing the checks.
Yeah, it's kind of like Pravda or North Korean television. I mean, that's taken it a little bit far. But so what are the next steps here to deal with this craziness?
Well, I mean, I think the next step, people who don't like this, they have to push hard on Congress. Trump has shown interest in doing this, but Congress has been weak on this issue forever because they get phone calls from the left and harassment from the media. I mean, the second this issue comes up, it came up right at the beginning of the Trump presidency. As soon as it comes up, journalists from everywhere, oh, you can't defund the media. There's CNN screaming about this in their newsletters, that this is a step toward a banana republic, that we would defund public media because they are desperate for cash now, to the point where they've been talking for several years about trying to get money, not just for this, but all sorts of media outlets. They would control that money too.
Well, my guess is that, if they are defunded, in other words, if taxpayer funds go away, they're still going to do this kind of thing. And the only thing that might change that is if viewers, parents in particular, who plop their children down in front of Sesame Street, contact them and complain. Although even so, I think they're so agenda driven that they really are not going to listen to that much anymore either. What do you think?
Oh, I don't think they listen, but I think that what they do acknowledge is when people don't watch. And this is why parents particularly need to get involved in whatever programs and music and all the kids are involved with, because if they don't, kids will watch garbage.
Yeah, that's absolutely critical, absolutely important to do that, for parents to know what their kids are watching. Sit down and you know, spend a little time in front of that television. By the way, has this particular episode already aired, or is it coming up?
No, I think it's coming up. So,
all right.
So something for parents to be looking for, not to have their kids see.
That's right. Dan Gaynor, Vice President for TechWatch Business and Culture at the Media Research Center, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, kind of a related topic, transgenderism in sports. Why is it unfair for females to be forced to compete against biological males? We'll talk to Dr. Michelle Cotrella, Executive Director of the American College of Pediatricians, coming up right after this.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council and host of Washington Watch. I invite you to join our family and thousands of others across the country in standing on the Word of God as we go into 2020, the global year of the Bible, by joining in a 2-year family chronological Bible reading plan. I can assure you that your family will be powerfully impacted by reading God's Word and growing in the understanding of His truth together. The readings take only 15 to 20 minutes a day, with Sundays set aside for a family or small group discussion. To join us, simply go to TonyPerkins.com and click on Stand on the Word with FRC. That's TonyPerkins.com or call 800-225-4008. That's 800-225-4008. Let's stand together on the Word of God and change the world, beginning in our own home.
Last year, my brother Josh, a 37-year-old married father with 5 kids under the age of 9, announced he was becoming a woman. Josh changed his name to Melissa and now requires everyone to use she, her pronouns when referring to him. If the grandparents refuse to do this, they've been threatened with limited access to their grandchildren. My tall, handsome, muscular brother began taking strong female hormones that transformed him into a different person. He began wearing dresses, wigs, heels, and makeup in public. He will have to stay on female hormones until the day he dies. He refuses to answer to the name Josh now. He says Josh is dead. There was even some type of symbolic burial ceremony to say goodbye to Josh, once and for all. You've been listening to an excerpt from a 6-part series telling the true account of a family impacted by the transgender movement. To read this important blog series, visit frc.org/cult.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. Chelsea Mitchell is one of the top female sprinters in Connecticut, but she's been denied the title of state champion 4 times because the State Association of Athletics in Connecticut has allowed male athletes to compete as girls. Transgenderism is growing in sports, and female athletes aren't happy about it, whether it's having to share a locker room, which is just plain crazy, or the physical advantages that come with being a biological male. The argument for the left is that the estrogen transgender females take in should neutralize their male advantages, but that's not the case. And that's a pretty weak argument anyway. Joining me now to talk about it is Executive Director of the American College of Pediatricians, Dr. Michelle Cotrella. Michelle, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, all right. Tell us a little bit about this. I was reading from an article that Alliance Defending Freedom put out about a lawsuit that has been filed on behalf of 3 of these young ladies in Connecticut to stop this silliness, this foolishness. A number of titles, females, ladies, young ladies have lost titles to guys who are claiming to be girls, which we know is biologically impossible. You're going to tell us a little bit more about the science and medicine. So where would you like to start off?
I think the most important fact to get across is estrogen does not guys doping estrogen, that's what we're talking about, men who dope estrogen do not become women. No one's sex can change. Sex is determined at fertilization. Sex declares itself in the womb. We can see it with ultrasound. And then sex is recognized at birth. So transgenderism has absolutely zero to do with science, everything to do with ideology. kudos to these three very brave young women and their families for taking a stand.
That's right. They're going to be filing a lawsuit against the CIAC, which I assume is the Connecticut something or other of athletic.
Interscholastic Athletic Council, I believe.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, what are they? You know what the basis of that lawsuit is? We tried to get a hold of ADF, but of course they're very, very busy and they're involved in this thing. But what is the basis of the suit? What are they trying to argue?
Well, the basis here is pure biology. Males and females are different. There are, and it's not just the Y chromosome that distinguishes males from females. There are at least 6,500 genetic differences that have been identified, and that's a minimum of 6,500 genetic differences between males and females. And the bottom line is, men are bigger, faster, stronger than women because of their hard wiring, the hardware. It's not just software that's different. Even the muscle fibers, men's muscle fibers, are biochemically different, biochemically stronger, faster reaction times as compared to women. Their bone structure is different. It goes beyond mere hormones.
So there's no surprise then that, and I think in this case there were just a couple of guys who were trying to, you know, basically run as girls, who have just knocked out a bunch of records that the young ladies have set. It makes complete sense.
Right. In this particular, and what's truly outrageous is that, so I think the two young men go by the names Andrea Yeager and Terry Miller. And when they were mediocre. They both ran on the male high school track team and were mediocre as boys. They later identified as transgender, and when Andrea Yeager, the male, started running on the girls' team, he wasn't even doping any estrogen. So it was truly, there was nothing to even disadvantage him from his male
benefits.
From the level of benefits in any capacity, right? And that's what the key thing is here. It's just self-identification. You don't even have to dope the estrogen to give you a disadvantage as a male compared to other males. The bottom line is, these are young men. They should be excluded from girls' sports because they are young men. And it doesn't matter what drugs they take, what hormones are shot into their system, what body parts are removed, they will remain young men and should be excluded from girls' sports. There's no level playing field, period. It just doesn't happen between young men and young women, men and women.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, the left and the LGBT, WXYZ folks, advocates, have been pushing this way too far. And it's, as you said, it's great that these three young ladies are using the wonderful services of Alliance Defending Freedom to push back against this craziness. So thanks for the work that you do. Appreciate it very much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, we'll talk about recent Christian persecution with FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, Travis Weber, and FRC's Research Assistant for FRC Center for Religious Liberty, Ariel Del Turco. After the break, you're listening to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. So glad you're listening. Stick with us. We'll be right back after this next break.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy and the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemical-abortion.
China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at frcblog.com.
What other trip to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, President of Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. You'll discover the roots of your faith and learn from experts about the geopolitical landscape of the region. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
We all need to be lectured sometimes. Family Research Council's new podcast features selected talks by top thinkers from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast podium takes on tough issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Listen with us to the lecture, then stick around afterward as we break down the content. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Ever heard the term toxic masculinity? Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Some progressive universities are offering courses to help men unlearn rigid definitions of masculinity, treating it as if it were a mental health condition. Thankfully, the culture doesn't have the last word on manhood. God does. Check out our StandCourageous.com for an event in your area. That's StandCourageous.com.
Well, thanks for listening today to Washington Watch. I've been Fowler in for Tony Perkins. Let me tell you about a trip to Israel that Tony Perkins is going to be leading here pretty soon. If you've ever considered traveling to Israel or want to go again, you and your family and friends are invited to spend an incredible 9 days in the Holy Land with Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann from June 2nd through the 12th. Not only will the Bible come alive in transforming ways, but you'll hear directly from Israeli defense, political, and religious leaders about what's happening right now in Israel and the Middle East. For more information about the trip, visit TonyPerkins.com. Well, again, welcome back to this final segment in today's Washington Watch broadcast. We're going to be talking about religious persecution here, and I just want to read a couple of examples to set this up. Quote, "We will cut you, we will kill you, we will do anything we want to you. The threat, Arjun and Neha knew, was real. Cut off from the village well, the only source of water, the family left carrying what they could. They had just become Christians, and like a lot of places in India, the decision to follow Jesus was a dangerous one. God didn't call me to a life of comfort, one of the persecuted said. He will never promise me that, but he does promise to walk with me." Here's another example. Mohan points to a field of wheat. "I loved my village," he says. "It was my favorite place. We worked the farm. Then one terrifying day, people broke down his door and destroyed everything in his home. We made a small hut by the church, and that's where we live. We have nothing." For people watching from the West, the stories are more and more alarming. News reports show a record number of violent attacks against Christians in India is rising, and rising fast. Well, as you can tell, Christian persecution is still a daily occurrence. persecution of Christians in India is at its highest levels, and Rohingya Christian refugees are being abducted. In brighter news, though, a Pakistani girl has been reunited after a kidnapping. Joining me to talk about all of this is FRC's, that's Family Research Council's, Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, Travis Weber, and FRC's Research Assistant for FRC's Center for Religious Liberty, Ariel Del Turco. Thanks, both of you, for joining us on the broadcast today.
Thanks very much.
All right, so I set it up with a couple of stories, and that's just two of probably millions of stories that are out there. Tell us about what's going on in those countries, as well as other places like Hong Kong, Pakistan, China, et cetera. What's the current situation?
Sure. So, you know, in opening, you mentioned India, and India is one of these places that is displaying an alarming alarming trend on religious freedom worldwide when we look at, you know, some of the issues around the globe, and yet it often does not get a lot of attention in the public consciousness or from governments and others who typically track these issues. And, you know, some of the rankings, I think it was the Open Doors ranking for most difficult countries to be a Christian. India is higher than some of the more well-known places that we think of when it comes to persecution in the Middle East. And what's behind that is really a very aggressive approach to this idea of people not being permitted to convert away from Hinduism, backed by developing anti-conversion laws in a lot of areas of the country. There's a very aggressive mentality or linkage between being Hindu and being Indian. And people who convert away from Hinduism or being perceived as converting others away from Hinduism get the brunt of social hostility. What makes this further complicated is the fact that when you look at, you know, some of the legal protections on the books, there are some protections for religious liberty in place. But as is the case with many areas around the globe, there's a big difference between stated legal protections or what should be protecting people and the actual cultural condition, the hostility of the one's community to people based on their choice of how they want to exercise their faith. So India is very bad. It's being driven, the approach to Christians, the hostility they face is being driven by these prohibitions on people converting away from Hinduism, and it's just it doesn't meet the standard for international religious freedom articulated, as we understand it, in Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which allows people to choose to live out their faith as they see fit and choose to exercise the faith of their choice. So I'm glad that we're helping highlight this for the listener because it's a trend that people need to know about.
Well, we're going to be talking about religious persecution in several countries here in the time that we have together. And then hopefully, Travis and Ariel, we can talk about some ways that listeners can get involved and help. And I know sometimes we just feel helpless because this stuff's going on the other side of the world. There's just not a whole lot that we seem to be able to do to grasp that. So I want to maybe talk about that toward the end here. Ariel, you and Travis co-authored an op-ed on Pakistan. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the situation in Pakistan is really problematic. We're seeing where it's not just religious persecution, but it's religious persecution that's harming Christian girls and young women the most. In Pakistan, Christians are treated like second-class citizens, so when they encounter legal problems, the courts are often reluctant to help them. One of the issues that women face there are that they will actually be abducted, kidnapped, forced to convert to Islam, and forced to marry a Muslim man. And the response by the government is really inadequate.
Go ahead, Travis.
To bring this kind of back in perspective here for, you know, what Ariel just articulated is a genuine forced conversion, right? And here, India, take you back to India, is purporting to be against forced conversion. In reality, these laws are prohibiting, you know, the free exercise of faith, the free exercise of sharing the message of the gospel with non-Christians. And that's properly within the realm of what should be protected under international religious freedom standards. With regards to India, we know President Trump is visiting India in a state visit February 24th, 25th. This is really an opportunity for the president, our president has made a point on international religious freedom by laying out a policy of pushing it and supporting it around the world. Several ministerials to advance religious freedom, the recently launched International Religious Freedom Alliance. Here's an opportunity to confront India on its problematic treatment of Christians. Prime Minister Modi has looked the other way as these issues have grown worse. And on his reign, since 2014, Alliance Defending Freedom has observed a 220% increase in violent attacks against Christians while Modi's in power. He has to answer for this, and President Trump is in a good place to ask him about it, to challenge him on it. President Trump has made a point to ask a Nigerian leader about its treatment, that country's treatment of Christians and others. And so for our president, who's made a point of defending Christians on the world stage, this is an opportunity to do so again in India.
Well, you know, and let's talk about India. Not only are Christians persecuted, but if you're not Hindu, pretty much you're fair game. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the situations vary depending upon a lot of circumstances. It's a huge country. It is a complex country, and you know, as anyone observing the landscape there will say, it's not like these problems are uniformly taking place across the country, are prevalent everywhere, take the same form everywhere, and so. I think we can fairly categorize this, though, as hostility to Christians just evangelizing their faith under the supposed need to prohibit forced conversions. But there's no force here. There's just sharing of one's faith. There is also a lot of government hostility against the Muslim community in India. And, this is something that that we're observing in government's increased requirements in cordoning off the Muslim community in the north of India and kind of making them jump through a number of hoops that it's not making other non-Muslims jump through. And, you know, there's issues for other religious communities, too, in India. It's a large and diverse country. But I think the point of this is, you know, we heard about Pakistan. We're talking about India. We know there are ongoing issues in China, as our listeners know well, and developments there indicate possible turn for the worse in terms of religious freedom in Hong Kong. There's just a host of things going on around the world that Christians in the United States need to understand, need to know about in order to pray and act on. While we still have our freedom here, we have the opportunity to speak up on behalf of many around the world who cannot speak up for themselves at this moment.
That's right. Well, Ariel, you know, Travis just mentioned Hong Kong and China. Can you bring us up to date on what's going on in Hong Kong? Apparently, there is a new hardline chief. I'm not sure what he's the chief of, but he's known as a crusader against Christian churches. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Hong Kong or China recently replaced their director of affairs for Hong Kong. So this is how the government in Beijing will be relating to Hong Kong. And he is actually known for his effort to crack down on Christians in the Chinese province that he was a Communist Party leader in. So he is especially known for tearing down crosses off of churches, working to re-identify them as being Chinese-focused and not focused on Christ, and then also for shutting down completely underground churches, these churches that are operating without the direct authority of the government. And, of course, they're doing that to avoid the type of strict influence that the Chinese government tries to have on the mainland churches that are approved.
Now, either one of you, I'd like you to maybe give us a little bit of basic education and information here. And let's talk about China in particular. Why is it that the Chinese government is afraid of the growth of the church? Travis, you want to comment on that?
Sure. So, you know, I think this, in terms of the mentality of the Chinese government, this all goes back to its view of its philosophy on the relationship between government and religion. It genuinely sees religion and religious actors as within the proper authority of government to control. It doesn't see religious institutions as deriving their authority from God, answering directly to God, religious believers being obligated to answer directly to God. The Chinese government sees religion as a natural part of government's inherent authority to regulate society, and therefore it will regulate religious institutions and communities consistent with that approach. Therefore, when it sees these religious communities as threatening the vision of the state that the current Chinese regime is laying out, it's going to regulate and act coercively and forcibly to bring them into line. But this, you know, China is an issue we've talked about a lot, and Ariel actually wrote a paper for us on religious freedom in China. We review the government's approach to not only the Christian communities, but the Uyghur Muslim communities. We've had an event here at FRC recently highlighting some stories from that area and other religious minorities in China. And you've really researched this in terms of understanding what's going on there, because we have an opportunity to work for the betterment of religious freedom in China right now. President Trump is obviously negotiating a lot of things with China on the trade front. But we need to include religious freedom in the mix and make sure that we defend religious freedom in China, stand up for it there, and defend it in Hong Kong when that's under assault, too.
Well, Ariel, Travis just mentioned that you had written a paper here. In just a moment, I'd like you to kind of give us an overview or an abstract of the content of that work. But, you know, Travis, you mentioned that the Trump administration is obviously, it's been in the news quite a bit, they're negotiating for different kinds of trade deals with China. Oftentimes in the past, it seems like things like human rights, religious freedom, and those sorts of things have been ignored because those on our side who are trying to do the negotiations are afraid of offending the other party, in this case China, and so they don't press them on that sort of thing. But what it sounds like you're saying is that this administration is not afraid to include that in the mix. Am I right?
That's correct. They're not afraid to include it in the mix, and we need to keep including it in the mix. The Trump administration has called attention to China's abuses of religious freedom in terms of companies doing business in a way that makes them complicit with human rights abuses in the Xinjiang area where the Uyghurs live. And we know Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, went to Hong Kong, delivered a strong speech against China's abuses of religious freedom. And this is something I'm celebrating. We've celebrated here at FRC, and I think all Americans should celebrate as defenders of religious freedom, because the United States needs to defend it forcibly in the international community, where there are sometimes a lack of religious freedom advocates in different areas of the world. Certainly within the Chinese government current regime, there are a lack of religious freedom advocates. And so I'm glad for President Trump's celebration or articulation defense of religious freedom. We need to do the same thing with India when he meets with Prime Minister Modi shortly, and everywhere else around the world we're currently engaged, such as we've been doing with Iran, North Korea, and elsewhere.
Yeah, and as Americans, we should be more concerned about the rights of those folks on the other side of the pond. That's a lot more important than getting cheap goods, for sure. Ariel, just give us a quick overview of your work on China, and then we'll wrap it up here with a final quick question about what our listeners can do.
Yeah, so really what we're seeing in China is a crackdown on people of all faiths, and it's really because China views any appeal to a higher authority or any loyalty to a higher authority as a threat to the authority of the party itself. So they're cracking down on Uyghur Muslims, as Travis mentioned, on Falun Gong practitioners, on Tibetan Buddhists, and on Christians. For the Uyghur Muslims, they've detained over 1 million in these what they call re-education centers, and it's really an attempt to strip them of any identity other than communism, and it's something we as Americans should be concerned about.
Absolutely. Well, Travis and Ariel, about out of time here. I would just say let's just make sure that we're praying for the persecuted around the world, our brothers and sisters. And there are a number of organizations that you can contribute to help. And you can also go to FRC.org and get information. Eben Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Thanks for listening.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action.
For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.